Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, Ashley Thompson and I report about the top 10 beaches around the world, according to the travel website TripAdvisor. Then we hear from Phil Dierking. He reports on an international student robotics competition held in Dakar, Senegal. And as always, we end our program with an American story. Today, we hear part one of Love of Life by Jack London. But first, let's have some fun in the sun. In summer, people around the world seek rest and relaxation on a beach. Depending on where you live, you might enjoy playing in ocean waves or visiting a beach along a peaceful lake or river. The American travel website company TripAdvisor publishes a list of the world's best beaches every year. The winners are based on the past year of ratings and reviews by TripAdvisor users worldwide. Today, we are going to explore this year's top 10 beaches in the world.
TripAdvisor named Brazil's Bahia do Sancho as this year's best beach in the world. Its water is calm and clear. Its sand is fine and soft. But getting to Bahia do Sancho is not so easy. It is on Fernando de Noronha, a volcanic island more than 300 kilometers off Brazil's coast. Travelers must take a plane or boat from major cities in northern Brazil to get there. And no more than 420 visitors can be on the island at one time. All of Fernando de Noronha is a national park. Bahia do Sancho is one of its two main beaches. Getting there involves walking along steep, rocky cliffs and then climbing down a ladder. But as one TripAdvisor user wrote, this is part of what makes the beach special. Sancho Bay is even made more hauntingly beautiful because of its remote location, thick vegetation, and rock cliffs.
While Bahia do Sancho is difficult to get to, TripAdvisor's second-ranked beach could not be much easier for tourists to reach. Grace Bay is on Turks and Caicos, a Caribbean island group south of the Bahamas. Travelers to the islands often choose to stay at oceanfront hotels right next to Grace Bay. This beach has impossibly clean and clear waters and pure white sand. Its calm waters make it extremely safe for swimming, snorkeling, or simply floating. Once on land, many visitors enjoy walking barefoot for several kilometers on the soft, warm sand.
To get to the third best beach, we head south to the Dutch Caribbean island of Aruba. like Grace Bay, Eagle Beach has clear, calm waters and soft white sand. It offers visitors a chance to try different water sports, including tubing and jet skiing. Eagle Beach may be best known, however, for its dramatic sunsets. On clear nights, the sky turns red, orange, and purple.
TripAdvisor's fourth best beach is also in the Caribbean. Playa Paraíso is on Cayo Largo, an island off Cuba's southern coast. Its name means Paradise Beach in English. Paraíso has a fun, laid-back restaurant for those who wish to eat and drink. There is little else on the beach. And that is exactly what visitors like about it. People come here for the sugar-like sand and calm waters filled with colorful wildlife.
Next, we visit the only U.S. beach to make it among TripAdvisor's top 10. Florida's Siesta Key is a low-lying island. The scientist known as Dr. Beach recently named Siesta Key the best beach in America, and for good reason. Siesta Key is on the Gulf of Mexico. It offers safe and clean waters, a big beach, stunning sunsets, and excellent seashell collecting. Visitors of all ages go to Siesta Key when the tide is low to find beautiful, large, and sometimes rare seashells.
Speaking of seashells, TripAdvisor's number 6 beach gets its name from a conch, a kind of large shell. La Concha Beach is in the city of San Sebastian, in northern Spain's Basque area. People come here to surf and swim in the Atlantic Ocean's La Concha Bay. They also enjoy walking along the wide, curved beach. La Concha is more developed than the other beaches on TripAdvisor's list. From the sandy coast, you can see San Sebastian's tall buildings and hear the sounds of city life. In fact, it is one of Europe's best-known urban beaches.
Cancun is one of Mexico's most famous beach resort areas. Near its coast is Isla Mujeres, or Island of Women. This is where you will find Playa Norte, number 7 on TripAdvisor's list of best beaches. Playa Norte has restaurants, bars, palm trees, and beach chairs to rent. It is one of the island's best places to snorkel. Summer visitors may even see whale sharks, the largest fish in the world. Many Playa Norte companies offer whale shark boat tours from May to September, and adventurous travelers can even jump in the water and swim with them.
Our next beach, Radhanagar, is on an island in the Indian Ocean. Radhanagar sits on the western coast of Havelock Island, part of the Indian territory of Andaman and Nicobar Islands. It is considered one of Asia's best beaches, with crystal clear waters and powder-like sand. Its reputation has made it a very popular beach. Visitors usually share the sands with plenty of people.
On the Greek island of Crete, TripAdvisor's 9th-ranked beach offers unspoiled natural beauty. Elafonisi Beach is known for its intensely turquoise-colored waters, pink sand, and black rocks. It is also known for being somewhat difficult to reach. The road to Elafonisi is narrow and takes many sharp turns. But that does not seem to stop people. It is filled with visitors year-round.
Probably no place on Earth is better known for wildlife than the Galapagos Islands. And the white sand Galapagos beach at Tortuga Bay does not disappoint in that respect. Hundreds of sea turtles build their nests there every year. Visitors may also see marine iguanas, sea lions, flamingos, and lava gulls, birds that are found only in the Galapagos. But perhaps the most famous creatures you might find here are the tiny Galapagos finches, also called Darwin's finches. They were named after scientist Charles Darwin. His theory of evolution was partly based on his study of the beaks of these birds.
From quiet, peaceful bays to city ocean fronts, TripAdvisor's list of the 10 best beaches offers something for every type of traveler.
Several hundred students spent last week building robots in Dakar, the capital of Senegal. The students are from middle schools and high schools in Senegal and neighboring countries. The robotics competition takes place once a year. Contest organizers say their goal is to urge governments and private donors to invest in science and mathematics education throughout Africa. Teams of young people gathered in Dakar for the Pan-African Robotics Competition. The theme of this year's competition was Made in Africa. The sound of machinery could be heard during the event. The students built small robots and used them to search for natural resources in the ground. Sidi Ndao created the competition. He says the students were asked to show how robotics developed in Africa can help local economies.
We've noticed that most countries that have developed in the likes of the United States have based their development on manufacturing and industrialization. And African countries, on the other hand, are left behind in this race. And so we thought it would be a good idea to inspire the kids, to tell them about the importance of manufacturing, the importance of industry, and the importance of creation and product development.
During the week, the students were separated into three groups. The first group created robots that would work in and organize storage centers. The second group created machines that would mine natural resources. The third one was asked to create an African product and tell how to build it. 17-year-old Rokyaya Cisse is from Senegal. She helped her team develop a robot that sends sound waves into the ground to search for metals and then begins digging. She says it is very interesting, fun, and they are learning new things, as well as having their first chance to operate robots. Abu Bakar Savage from Gambia was part of a younger team. He said his team's robot communicates with computers.
It's a robot that we, whatever you draw into the computer, it translates it and draws it in real life. It's kind of hard, and there's so much competition, but we're trying. I've learned how to assemble a robot. I've learned how to program into a computer.
17-year-old Mariam Touré and her team built a robot that would be able to work in a mine. She said, "This helps us get more involved in science. Learning to program robots allows us to develop a certain aptitude in robotics that will serve us in the future." Ousmane Lowe competed against Touré. He is also from Senegal. He says robots could solve agricultural problems in Africa. Right now, it's machines that dominate. What we can't do, machines can do, Lowe said. Sidi Ndao, who is from Senegal, is now a professor at the University of Nebraska's Lincoln College of Engineering.
I've realized how much the kids love robotics and how much they love science. And we could tell because when it's time for lunch, we would have to actually convince them to actually leave. And when it's time to go home, nobody wants to leave.
Ndao said he hopes the event will persuade African governments and private individuals to invest in science and mathematics education, especially in universities. He said the idea is that we would have African universities that have similar or perhaps better standards than European and American universities, so that the students who, the thousands or millions of them in Africa, have the chance to have a higher state-of-the-art education in the continent. I'm Phil Dierking.
Now it's time for an American story. Today we hear part one of Love of Life by Jack London.
The two men moved painfully down the bank and fell among the rocks that were scattered everywhere. They were tired and weak. Their faces showed the patient appearance that results from difficulty long endured. They were heavily burdened with blanket packs, which were tied to their shoulders. Each man carried a gun. They walked in a leaning position, the shoulders forward, the head farther forward, the eyes fixed upon the ground.
"I wish we had a couple of those cartridges that are lying in our cache," said the second man. His voice was completely without expression. And the first man, walking into the milky stream that flowed over the rocks, made no reply. The other man followed at his heels. They did not remove their shoes, although the water was icy cold. It was so cold that their feet soon were without feeling. In places, the water dashed against their knees, and both men found it difficult to remain standing. The man who followed slipped upon a smooth rock and nearly fell. He recovered his footing with great effort, at the same time uttering a sharp cry of pain. He seemed faint, and stretched one hand forward, seeking support against the air. When he had steadied himself, he stepped forward, but he slipped again and nearly fell. Then he stood still and looked at the other man, who had never turned his head. The man stood still for fully a minute, as if he were deciding something. Then he called out,
I say, Bill, I hurt my foot.
Bill struggled ahead through the milky water.
He did not look around. The man watched him go, and although his face lacked expression as before, his eyes had the look of a wounded animal. The other man climbed the farther bank of the stream and continued straight ahead, without looking back. The man in the stream watched him. His lips trembled a little. "Bill!" he cried. It was the despairing cry of a strong man in trouble, but Bill's head did not turn. The man watched him go, struggling forward up the hill toward the skyline. He watched him go until he passed over the hilltop and disappeared. Then he turned his gaze and slowly examined the circle of the world that remained to him, now that Bill was gone. The sun was low in the sky, almost hidden by a cover of clouds. The man looked at his watch while supporting his weight on one leg. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The season was near the end of July or the 1st of August. He did not know the exact date within a week or two, but that was enough to know that the sun marked the northwest. He looked to the south and decided that somewhere beyond those hills lay the Great Bear Lake. Also, he knew that behind the same hills, the Arctic Circle cut its way across the plains of northern Canada, called the Barrens. This stream in which he stood flowed into the Coppermine River, which in turn flowed north and emptied into the Arctic Ocean. He had never been there, but he had seen it once on a map. Again, his gaze completed the circle of the world about him. It was not a cheerful sight. Everywhere was soft skyline. The hills were all low-lying. There were no trees, no grasses. There was nothing but a vast emptiness that brought fear into his eyes. "Bill!" he whispered once and twice. "Bill!" He stood trembling in the milky water, feeling the vastness pressing in upon him with great force. He began to shake as with a disease, until the gun falling from his hand into the stream brought him back to reality. He fought with his fear and regained his self-control. He recovered the gun from the water. He pushed his pack more toward his left shoulder. This helped to take a portion of its weight off the foot he had hurt. Then he proceeded slowly and carefully, in great pain, to the bank of the stream. He did not stop, with a worry that was madness, unmindful of the pain. He hurried up the hill to the top over which his companion had disappeared. But at the top he saw a valley empty of life. He fought with his fear again and won. Then once more he moved the pack farther toward his left shoulder and struggled down the hill. The bottom of the valley was very wet. Thick plant life held the moisture close to the surface, and the water flowed from under his feet at every step. He picked his way carefully across the valley and followed the other man's footsteps along the rocks, which made small islands in the sea of wet plant life. Although alone, he was not lost. Farther on, he knew, he would come to where dead pine trees bordered the shore of a little lake. In the language of that country, it was called the Land of Little Sticks. Into that lake flowed a small stream, the water of which was not milky. There was grass along that stream, but no trees. He would follow the stream until it divided. He would cross this place of dividing to another stream flowing to the west. This he would follow until it emptied into the River Dease. Here he would find a cache under an upturned boat covered with many rocks. In this cache there would be cartridges for his empty gun, and fish hooks and lines. Everything he needed for catching food would be there. Also he would find flour, a little meat, and some beans. Bill would be waiting for him there, and they would find a boat and row south down the Dease to the Great Bear Lake. And south across the lake they would go, ever south, until they came to the Mackenzie River, and south. Always south they would go, while the winter raced after them, and the ice formed in the streams, and the days grew cold. South they would go, to some warm place where the trees grew tall and full, and there was food without end. These were the thoughts of the man as he struggled forward. But as strongly as he struggled with his body, he struggled equally with his mind. He tried to believe that Bill had not deserted him. Surely Bill would wait for him at the cache. He was forced to think this thought. Otherwise, there would not be any reason to continue. And he would lie down and die. As the ball of the sun sank slowly into the northwest, he recalled every inch of his and Bill's flight south ahead of the oncoming winter, and he thought again and again of the food in the cache. It had been 2 days since he had anything to eat. It was a far longer time since he had had enough to eat. Often he picked muskeg berries, put them into his mouth, and ate them. A muskeg berry is a small seed in a drop of water. In the mouth, the water melts away and the seed tastes bitter. The man knew there was no real food value in the berries, but he ate them, patiently, with a hope greater than his experience. At 9 o'clock that night, he hit his toe on a rocky surface, and from weakness and tiredness, he fell to the ground. He lay for some time without movement on his side. He took his pack from his back and dragged himself into a sitting position. It was not yet dark. While some light remained, he felt among the rocks for pieces of dried plants. When he had gathered a pile, he built a fire and put a tin pot of water on it to boil. He unwrapped his pack. The first thing he did was to count his matches. There were 67. He counted them 3 times to be sure. He divided them into several portions, wrapping them in paper. He put one portion in his empty tobacco pack, another in the inside band of his hat, and a third under his shirt against his flesh. This accomplished, he began to worry whether he had counted correctly. He unwrapped them all and counted them again. Yes, there were 67. He dried his wet shoes and socks by the fire. The moccasins were badly torn. His socks were worn through in places, and his feet were bleeding. The area between his foot and leg, the ankle, was very painful. He examined it. It had swelled until it was as large as his knee. He cut a long strip from one of his 2 blankets and bound the ankle tightly. He cut other strips and bound them about his feet to serve both for moccasins and socks. Then he drank the pot of hot water, wound his watch, and pulled his blankets around him. He slept like a dead man. The brief darkness at midnight came and went. Then the sun rose in the northeast. It can be better said that day dawned in that quarter of the sky because the sun was hidden by gray clouds. At 6 o'clock in the morning, he waked, quietly, lying on his back. He gazed straight up into the gray sky and knew that he was hungry. As he lifted himself on his elbow, he was frightened by a loud noise. There was a caribou looking at him curiously. The animal was not more than 50 feet away. And instantly into the man's mind came the picture of caribou meat cooking over a fire. From habit, he reached for the empty gun and aimed it. The caribou leaped away and disappeared across the rocks.
That was part one of Love of Life by Jack London. That's all the time we have for the program today. But tune in tomorrow for another Learning English program on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.